of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome today the Oconomowoc High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you very much for coming this morning. You may be seated. And we're delighted to welcome J.I. Case High School. Would those students please stand? We're delighted to welcome you all, including faculty or parents who are here. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with us with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. And under this program, we have invited students from all the high schools in the state. If the students accept our invitation, they are sent materials about the case, including the briefs, and they may have done not only reading on the case, but have had other materials presented to them, including perhaps lawyers. And then the last aspect after they attend the oral argument is that they will meet after the second oral argument this morning with a justice of this court. And today, the justice that with whom you, the students, meet will be Justice Bradley, and everyone is invited to the session with Justice Bradley. It will be a discussion of the procedures of the court, not the substance of the cases we're going to hear. So we've met you. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'll start with Justice Bradley, who's on my immediate left. And seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. And on the far end, at the left end of the bench, is Justice Patience Rogensack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and to my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, we'll call our first case, 02-1727, Kenosha Hospital Medical Center versus Jesus E. Garcia. Christopher William Rose, representing the defendant, appellant petitioner, Richter Industries. Mr. Rose. Having some difficulty with the acoustics in the room, so we may have to ask you to make adjustments, but we'll deal with that as we go forth.
All right, thank you. Chief Justice Abramson and other members of the Supreme Court, it's certainly an honor to be here. Again, I am representing the petitioner in this case, Richter Industries, and the facts of the case, which I will briefly review, are these. Kenosha Hospital, the plaintiff in this case, filed a complaint versus Mr. Jesus Garcia, defendant for $20,888.85. In August of 2001, August 28th, the trial court ordered judgment in favor of Kenosha Hospital for that amount versus Mr. Garcia. In September of 2001, an earnings garnishment was filed by Kenosha Hospital. It was served on Richter Industries' payroll department in October of 2001. In December of 2001, a notice of motion for judgment was filed against the garnishee, or the employer in this case, who I'm representing, Richter Industries.
Also, can I just interrupt, just to ask you a question? I notice, and this was missed, and you pointed it out in the Court of Appeals opinion about the $527.64 that was held back from Garcia's. When was that taken out of his wages, sir? Was that in...
It was taken out somewhere between, I believe it was the end of October or November, and I believe December or January of 2002.
Does it make any difference that it was just held?
I'm sorry?
In other words, they held the money.
Well, it's our position that it does make a difference because the Court of Appeals said nothing was withheld, and therefore
yes.
The Cook case didn't apply. First of all, I believe that that is an incorrect conclusion of the Court of Appeals. And specifically the reason why is because what they were ruling is that because no wages of the debtor, Mr. Garcia, were withheld by Richter at any point, therefore the trial court, had jurisdiction in this case to enter judgment against Richter Industries.
Yeah, because it on the record it shows the trial court simply deducted that from the $20,000.
Correct.
Yeah, that, there's no argument about that at all.
No, there isn't. And that's in the order of the court that was entered on January 7th of 2002. Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're not able to give any greater specificity to the dates of when it was withheld and the date that it was paid. Is that correct?
Well, I don't have the – I believe the dates were the end of October and the beginning of until – December of 2002. I believe that's in the record, though. I just don't have that exact date.
Before the January 7th filing of the bankruptcy?
Well, actually, I believe there were some wages that were withheld after the January 7th filing of the bankruptcy.
That's not – I missed that, I guess. When were – is that in our record here?
Yeah, I believe that is.
You must have just missed it. Other than the about $67 or $70. You're talking about additional monies, too.
Actually, the only monies that were withheld was that
$527,
correct. Nothing else was withheld. And then the judgment was entered on January 7th for the $20,784.21. That was the $20,888 minus the $527, and the judgment was for the $20,784. Seems that an amicus curiae brief was filed in the Court of Appeals by the State Bar. And it seems, at least upon my reading, they pretty much accepted the arguments, the amicus curiae, and one of the things that they had argued was that no wages were ever withheld, and that simply wasn't the case, which was somewhat surprising.
Could I ask a factual question? From the time that Richter was supposed to be acting as a garnishee, and January 2nd, exactly how much should have been withheld and paid over?
Well, that figure I'm not 100% certain of, but I do know that pursuant to law, it would be 20% of his wages. So certainly it wouldn't have been the entire amount of the judgment of over $20,000. It's probably something close to the $527 that was withheld, although I don't have an exact number.
Does the record list what his wages were or how much was held, withheld for each pay period or anything like that?
Well, I believe it reflects how much was the amounts that were withheld per pay period by Richter Industries, and I think they withheld about 8 of his paychecks, and that totals the $527 that was withheld. How much, what his exact wages were, no, I'm not certain of that.
What are we fighting about here?
Well,
we're fighting about the $500?
Well, no, it's not our position really that we're fighting about the $500. I mean, that was
the judgment against you for
$20,000, correct.
Okay.
Right, exactly. And it's our position that the Kenosha Hospital, regardless of the $527 withheld or not, it isn't really relevant. It's only relevant to the Court of Appeals decision, which I think was ruled incorrectly, number one, and they simply misapplied the law in terms of the Cook case when they cited to that. But it's our position that the plaintiff, Kenosha Hospital, violated the automatic stay of the bankruptcy court here when judgment was entered on January 7th of 2002 in favor of Richter Industries against Mr. Garcia.
Counselor, I'd like to move you back to the beginning of the garnishment a little bit. When I looked at the record, being an old practitioner, I didn't see the usual papers in the record that are customarily served on a garnishee defendant when a garnishment is started. And I refer you to Section 81244 sub 3. That requires not a notice of garnishment, which is a direction to the clerk of court that a garnishment action has been begun, but a separate document. I couldn't find it in the record. I got it off a CCAP, not from this record, but to see what is available for garnishment actions, and I checked the statutes, and to me, what is in the record is not what was required to be served under subsection C. Three. And I'm wondering, is there another document that was served in September at the beginning of this garnishment other than the notice of garnishment, which is currently part of our record?
I am not aware of any. I was not representing Richter Industries in the beginning. I came in afterwards. The only thing I'm aware of is that an earnings garnishment notice was served on a plant in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Okay, well, I'm not worried about where it was served. I'm worried about what was served. And my other question is, was a $15 payment served with that notice? There's nothing in the record about that either, and the statutes require a payment of $15 to begin an action against a garnishee for the debtor's wages. Do you know if that was served? There's nothing in the record about it that I could find.
I reviewed the record also before going before the trial court. No, I did not.
You just don't know one way or the other?
Well, I didn't see it in there is my the answer to
yeah,
the question.
Yeah, well, I didn't see it either. Okay, so, I just thought maybe you knew something. All right,
right.
Thank you.
Okay.
So the question, well, I guess would follow up, if that wasn't served, then would your position change? I mean, you're arguing that there was invalid service, right?
That's one of the arguments, yes.
Well, I think just to follow up on Justice Rogensack's question, if the summons was not there and it's required by statute, which she cited, or the $15 payment, would that make?
It would certainly make a huge difference, obviously, because if it wasn't properly served.
I just looked through this record here, and I can't. Now, this may not be the entire. Obviously, this is not the entire record that's in front of us. I did not see it.
Yeah, I did not either.
Asking the question.
Right. I did not see it either. I did review the record prior to us going back into court. I'm sorry.
Is this the entire record?
I don't think so.
I don't know what we're looking
at. It might be in a garnishment action.
Well,
usually not mine.
Usually our papers show if there's a separate box or a separate division, and there is none. So sometimes we get a very limited record on a PO. And what we have here is the docket sheet. Well, we've got the clerk's statement of what is the index to the record that was forwarded to the Court of Appeals, summons, complaint, affidavit, judgment, notices. This is the entire record.
I did review that before I went before the Court of Appeals, and yes, I believe that is the entire record in this case that was forwarded. Obviously, either one of us would have had the opportunity to amend that before the court if we felt it wasn't. I didn't notice any papers in that record that were not forwarded after I'd reviewed the record at the courthouse in Kenosha. So, in any event, it is our position that there was a violation here of the automatic stay. It's our position that the stay of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court prohibited Kenosha Hospital from obtaining a default judgment against Richter Industries. Why is that? Well, we cited to the court the case of N. Ray O'Connor at 42 BR 390, which states that a stay is effective on the date of filing. So even if the creditor here at Kenosha Hospital didn't even know of the filing, this only means that the garnishment action in this case that occurred is not willful or intentional. It doesn't mean that there was no violation. It just means that damages couldn't be assessed against the garnishee in this case. The garnishee in this case. It's our position further that it makes no difference whether or not the garnishment was filed prior to or after the bankruptcy action was filed. There is a distinction, I believe, made by Kenosha Hospitals that there is a distinction here that if the garnishment action was filed prior to the bankruptcy action, that it makes all the difference in the world, and therefore there's no violation of the automatic stay. But clearly, it is our position that, first of all, the trial court, on this very same day that bankruptcy action was filed by Mr. Garcia, on January 7th of 2002, that very same day, judgment was entered in favor of Kenosha Hospital against the Garnaschi Richter Industries. So first of all, it is our position that that alone would constitute a violation of the automatic stay depriving the trial court of jurisdiction.
Counselor, but isn't the automatic stay a direction not to proceed against the debtor? And isn't this action that we're in court on an action that is not against the debtor, but rather against Richter's Industries?
Well, no. It is an action. The default judgment was entered against Richter Industries,
right,
clearly. But it is our position that that debt, being the debt not of Richter Industries, but of the debtor, Mr. Garcia, the employee, that, in fact, even if you have a default judgment against the Garnaschi, that that really is simply just an indirect proceeding against the debtor, Mr. Garcia.
Well, not really, because a default judgment arises out of a failure of the Garnaschi. It has nothing to do with actions or inactions by the debtor. It's because there wasn't a response that a default judgment was granted, and the response that was due was not from the debtor.
Well, that's correct. I understand that. But really, when you get right down to it, we're talking about, yes, it is a default judgment against the Garnaschi for failing to answer the complaint. But that particular debt that we're talking about has absolutely nothing to do with the Garnaschi. This is not their debt. This is simply the debt of Mr. Garcia. What the hospital is saying is the Garnaschi in this case, you didn't do what you were supposed to, and you didn't deduct those wages. You didn't respond to the complaint. Now we're going to file a default judgment against you. But the point is those wages, all of them, are discharged in bankruptcy. Yet in spite of this, a default judgment is entered saying we're going to collect those wages from you indirectly, even though they're not yours, they're really the debtors.
Yeah, but
and that's the position.
Counselor, you know, there's a lot of law out there that if you have two debtors on a note and one debtor files a bankruptcy, you can still go after the other person. So once you get, and you don't violate the automatic stay, so once you've got a default judgment, I understand what you're saying, that you can't proceed anymore against the debtor, but now you've got another obligor on the debt. And isn't that what the hospital is really trying to do here, is to proceed against a secondary obligor?
They're trying to proceed against the Garnaschi, who is not a co-debtor, on the who's responsible for the debt of Mr. Garcia in any respect.
Counsel, they can do that because of the failure, alleged failure, to respond and to appear in court. And opponent indicates that under the Knight case, which is, the Tennessee case that states that clearly that if here it was a default judgment and it does not prohibit actions against the non-debtor entity, which you are, I agree with that. This is not, didn't start out being your debt, but because of the failure to respond, default judgment taken, that's why it becomes your debt and does not fall into the bankruptcy class. That seems to be the argument that they make, and as you know, that's the argument that the Court of Appeals adopted.
Correct.
Under the Knight case.
Correct. Yes, I agree.
Why shouldn't this court follow that when I think the whole argument here is, and that's why this summons that Justice Rogensack asked about, I think is certainly interesting, because if the service was not there, then that would give some credence to this. But the question is, now we're talking about the default judgment. Clearly there was one, and you're saying, well, there wasn't because you can't do anything because it was wiped out in this bankruptcy.
Correct. I mean, clearly that is our position. And the reason why it's our position, and I think what needs to be done, and which we've pointed out, is, and the reason why I believe our position is a stronger position, is because what is going on here is that the purpose behind the Bankruptcy Act, I think, is being violated when you allow, or when trial court allows, the creditor to collect from a garnishee a debt of the debtor which is in no way the debt of the garnishee in this case. And the reason why, I think, is pointed out in the Alabama Hospitals case from the Northern District of Alabama. And that case talks about the purpose of the bankruptcy law. And the first is that the purpose is to allow a debtor complete relief and allow that debtor a fresh start. In other words, wiping clean any debts that a debtor owes. That's the purpose behind the bankruptcy law.
Sure, but then I know that argument is countered by the argument, well, he's going to get a fresh start, assuming, I don't know if he's working at Richter or not anymore, but the point is that your opponent makes the argument you can't garnish his wages or do anything because that would violate the Consumer Credit Protection Act and would prohibit you from firing him due to the fact that his wages might be garnished.
Correct. He
does get a fresh start.
Well, he did make that argument, but I would like to know, and I did point this out in my reply brief, that the Consumer Credit Protection Act would protect the employee from discharge for any one indebtedness. So in other words, if there was more than one indebtedness, and this may be that case, it may not be, but if there was any more than one indebtedness, it's our position that pursuant to that act, that in fact the employee would not be protected from any retribution or firing from an employer if they sought protection pursuant to that. So I don't even believe that they can state that in some way that act in and of itself provides the debtor with complete protection.
Counsel, I'm sorry. Please.
Go ahead.
I thought you were finished. I'm sorry.
I am on that point.
You argue here in your today, in the oral argument, and also in your brief, you make the equitable argument that this is not your debt. And yet when I look at the motion to vacate the default judgment, at least on paper, that wasn't the premise of your motion to vacate the default judgment. If I recall, you gave two reasons. One was that it was void, underlying judgment was void, and the other one was service should have been in Illinois. That's my recollection. I'm looking for that.
That's correct.
Is my recollection correct? Those were the two things that you argued. Did you argue this is not my debt or this is not our debt as an equitable argument?
Oh, that argument? Yes, I did make that argument to the trial court. That's in the transcript itself. And that was our primary focus, that this debt is not a debt of Richter Industries, but it's clearly a debt of Jesus Garcia. And that was the prime focus, in fact, of the reason why it was our position that because that this debt was discharged in bankruptcy court, therefore, this whole underlying judgment is void, regardless of at what point the default judgment was entered, whether it was prior to or subsequent to the filing of the bankruptcy action by Mr. Garcia, the defendant.
Mr. Rose, had the judge here signed the judgment on January 5, which is before there's a filing of bankruptcy, would you have a claim? Would you have a position?
Well, if it was filed, if the judgment was filed prior to it, it's our position that whether it's prior to or after, it doesn't make any difference.
Why?
Well, the whole point of the Bankruptcy Act is the stay stops all proceedings prior to and after. That's the whole purpose. So once you file a...
Even completed proceedings?
Even completed proceedings. If you have a debt that's been, or a judgment, the whole point of the Bankruptcy Act is that you can discharge that judgment if it's included in the bankruptcy petition.
But it's not a judgment against Garcia. It's judgment against you.
I understand that. It is a judgment against Richter Industries. But first of all, they could intervene in that bankruptcy action, in that bankruptcy court, I believe, number one. And number two, still, it is our position that it's not Richter Industries debt, but it's simply an indirect proceeding against the debtor in this case.
Now, does that rely in effect on minority cases in bankruptcy court? I mean, the Kenosha Hospital, if I read their brief, says that the majority position is that you'd be liable.
Right. Well, first of all, I think I did point this out again in my reply, was that I'm not at all certain. Certainly, that is the those are the words that have been used in some of the cases, that this is the majority position, ours is the minority position. I did refer to it as a majority position simply to, for simplicity's sake, in my brief. I didn't count out the number of states that favor A versus our position, but it does appear, at least from my review of the cases, that it does appear to be the majority position. But regardless if it's majority or minority position, clearly I think the minority position is the correct one. I think it's fair, I think it's just, and I think it serves the purpose of the point of the bankruptcy law and the if in fact, and I think this is an important point also, if in fact Kenosha Hospital were allowed to collect this debt from the garnishee, what would be happening here is we would be allowing a creditor to collect a debt from a garnishee and do those things against the garnishee, which could never be done against the creditor, the person who incurred the debt in the first instance.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it just seems to me the statute allows, if a employer, garnishee, does not respond, it allows judgment against that entity. So the statute is clear. If you don't respond, you get a judgment against you. Now, I think your argument is, regardless of whether we get a judgment or not, it's just not fair. But that isn't what the statute says. Why wouldn't, if the only way that you have to collect the judgment that they got against the Garcias is to go and garnishee the wages, and then there's no cooperation or there's no response, why wouldn't it be equitable to say, well, if you don't do anything, then you're held responsible?
Well, certainly the garnishment statutes in Wisconsin do allow for you to get a default judgment, but what I'm arguing is that you have to take that statute, and when we're talking about a bankruptcy action, you have to take both of those statutes, interpret them together to come up with what we would believe is an equitable result. I mean, the garnishment statute in and of it does not in any way address the bankruptcy, what happens when you file a bankruptcy, what happens when the debt is discharged.
Should it make any difference? In other words, if a employer, Richter Industries, doesn't respond and or allows a default to be taken, and the service is correct, and we find then what difference does it make?
Well, it would make a huge difference. If there's no bankruptcy action, then the debt is still valid. So if in fact they didn't bother to answer or respond, certainly in that instance, if you came to court and said they never responded, they didn't answer the complaint, we can get a default judgment against them. I mean, I think that's a big distinction that needs to be made.
It seems to me that under the facts of this case, if you were held liable for the $20,000, you certainly would have, I would think, maybe not, but I would think, a cause of action against Mr. Garcia for $20,000. Right?
I don't believe that would be the case. I think that very well may fall under, number one, this Consumer Credit Protection Act, possibly, if it's one indebtedness. But secondly, I believe, although I could be wrong, I quite frankly think that that may be prohibited from pursuing such an action.
Okay. So doesn't that help Mr. Garcia and the other creditors? I mean, you get stuck. But if you can, you're really, there are two possibilities. One, you're a substitute for Kenosha Hospital in the bankruptcy. Either you or them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't do it, then there's just, you can't sue. That's what you think the Consumer Protection Act says. Then he just has less debt and it's better for the rest of the creditors.
Well, again, I still think, though, that this Consumer Credit Protection Act, it protects only against one indebtedness. After that, it very well may not. Now, just because you may or may not be able to file some civil suit against the debtor doesn't mean necessarily that you can't get retribution in other ways by discharging him from employment. If he's an at-will employee, he can be discharged for any reason, first of all. So they don't even have to give a reason. Your employment is terminated. Now, what is preventing them from doing that? I don't see that there's anything preventing an employer from doing that.
That's the harm, potential harm to him.
That is a very great harm, I think, too.
Counselor, before you step down and your opponent steps up, because I may want to ask him as well, I want to know if Richter Industries sent any statutory notices to Mr. Garcia for the amounts of money they withheld, and if they did, are they in the record?
If Richter Industries sent him any notices for the amount?
Right. They're required to let him know that they're taking money out of his check and why. And my question to you is, did they do that? And if they did, are they in the record?
I don't believe that's in the record.
Okay. What record are we talking about? Are we talking about the record here, or are we talking about...
We were talking about the record on appeal.
Okay. We're not. There may be other things in the record at the trial court. Are there, or don't you know?
I wouldn't know. The file that I reviewed after the default, that I reviewed those things in the file, and I don't recall it being in there.
Thank you, Mr. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pearson, we'll change our lapel microphone. Representing Kenosha Hospital and Medical Center. Counsel, you were the trial counsel, at least that was what appears in the file before us. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, first we'll let you introduce yourself. You'll have to move that. Okay, thank you.
I represent Kenosha Hospital and Medical Center, the plaintiff in this proceeding. Morning to you and morning to all the guests. I didn't expect this crowd. Answering some questions that were raised to Mr. Rose, the $527 was collected by Richter and paid to the hospital after the plaintiff's motion was served on Richter and before the hearing on January 2nd.
The motion for default, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
A little background in service of garnishment. The garnishment notice that's in the court file, that is all that the court sees unless the garnishee does not respond, and then the court gets involved.
Counsel, I draw your attention to the statutes, which requires a different form.
There's an earnings garnishment that is served on the employer and the employee. That is not filed in the court, though.
Okay. Did you serve that? That's my question.
Absolutely.
It's not in the file.
Absolutely.
There's no affidavit that it was served either in the file.
I understand that, and that is part of the new earnings garnishment procedure, which separates the court from earnings garnishments. It's something done between the plaintiff and the employer without court supervision.
Right. I understand that. And, you know, my concerns basically are that you're seeking a judgment against someone that, as near as I can tell, was never told by anything that's in the record that if they didn't respond promptly, they could get socked with a $20,000 judgment. It tells you that you are garnishing their wages, but it gives no notice, which frankly bothers me. And what we have in the file is only the notice of garnishment. There is nothing in the file that shows, either by affidavit or by the document itself, that the form required by statute was actually served on Richter at any time.
There's nothing in the file, and the file that the court has probably is the entire record.
Okay.
The entire record was all by default, so there are no extensive records.
Well, then I guess, I have a real concern about whether the garnishment against Richter was properly commenced, and that's what all my questions go to. And, you know, we're here basically on a technicality in the statute that gives you this right because they did something they weren't supposed to. Well, from my perspective, in order to exercise that right, you have to show me that you did everything you were supposed to do. And I have concerns about there being a lack of notice to Richter, that they could get stuck with all of this. I have concerns that the statutorily required pleadings that are to be served on the garnishee are not in the record, nor is an affidavit they were ever served. So if you could address yourself to how you might deal with that, that would help me a whole bunch.
Well, I can represent to the court that the documents were in fact served. They were served by certified mail. They were signed for by Mr. Richter himself. Obviously, some documents were received by Mr. Richter, because if they weren't, that would clearly be the defense raised to the motion for a judgment.
Counsel, why wasn't this document filed with the court then? The notice of garnishment is filed with the clerk of court, but why isn't the document that says State of Wisconsin to the garnishee and provides for a $15 payment, was that sent, the $15
yes.
sent? And is there a record of that someplace that the
no.
payment was made? No.
I probably have a canceled check someplace, but there's nothing in the court record.
Do the statutes require you to file this?
No, Your Honor.
They do not.
So that's the point. The point is, you're saying the reason it isn't here, this is the whole record. And just so I get this straight myself, as an officer of the court in here, you're saying that isn't here because it's not required under the statute.
Correct. There would be a much more substantial record if Mr. Richter or a representative of Mr. Richter's company had responded to my motion for default judgment. At that time, he would have brought in Mr. Garcia's pay records, showing what he earned every week, showing what the 20% withholding would have been, and that would have capped Richter Industries' liability at 20% of Mr. Garcia's earnings from the time the earnings garnishment was served by certified mail and the court hearing. Richter Industries did not do that. Not only did they not respond to the earnings garnishment, they did not respond to the motion for judgment. And that motion is real clear. It specifically states that I, the attorney for Kenosha Hospital and Medical Center, was seeking a judgment against Richter Industries for the entire indebtedness of Garcia to the hospital. I honestly expected him to be there. The reason I use a process server rather than serving it by mail is to get the garnishee's attention. I do many garnishments, and before I file motions to bring it to court, my assistant calls garnishees saying, you've got this, you have to respond. And Mr. Rose says that in the interest of justice, this should be set aside. This is a case that where the judgment really should stand, because it's there because of the fault of Richter Industries.
Well, one, as I looked at this and I looked at the statute, you had to do the earnings, what do they call it, earnings garnishment notice, and that's here.
That's in the file, right.
That's right. And it's in the form that's required in the statute and has been approved by the judicial conference. That's how I understand that.
Correct.
And there is a statement, that's under 1 and 2. And under 3, there's another garnishment form, but that doesn't require that you have to send anything to court, as I read this.
That's as I'm understanding, yes. The court does not want that paperwork.
Well, whether it wants it or not, it's not required.
Correct.
Okay. So now you're up to getting a default judgment, and you're now serving it. And one of the arguments of defendant, Richter Industries, is you didn't serve it properly, right?
That's what he's claiming, correct.
Let's just talk about that for a few moments. You served it on a process server, and it was served on a
a secretary, apparently, who was unwilling to give her name, but the process server indicates that she seemed to be in control of the office.
And apparently claimed to be in charge.
Okay. What statute does that satisfy?
It's 80111 sub 5.
All right.
But I want to, that's service. I'm saying service is not necessary. The garnishment statute says we have to give notice to the garnishee. It's my position that notice could have been a letter, first-class mail. It could have been a fax to Richter Industries. It could have been another certified mail with return receipt. It was my decision to have the papers formally served on Richter Industries. And, again, there's only one person the process server found there.
And this was an office where?
In Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Okay. All right. So they do have an office there.
Yeah, they have a plant there, yes. That's another problem I have is Mr. Rose identifies this company as an Illinois corporation and claimed, therefore, I have to serve Richter Industries in Illinois. That is not the case. We have a Illinois corporation doing business in Wisconsin without a registered agent. Their last registered agent had an address of the plant in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Section 180 of the Wisconsin statutes even allows service of a summons on a foreign corporation that is no longer has a registered agent in Wisconsin by mailing the summons to its last known address. That's section 180.1510, sub 3 and 4.
Counselor, there was never a summons served on Richter in this case.
There is no summons in a garnishment.
Okay, so the provisions you're relying on for the basis for your default judgment, 801.11.5, speaks to the service of a summons. And in the summons, it says what will happen to you if you do not respond. That's why we use a summons to start action. So how does that provision apply if you didn't serve a summons?
Well, I guess I'm equating my motion, which told Richter what would happen or what I was be asking for. I would be asking for a judgment against Richter Industries. And that would be the same as a summons, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Is this judgment a personal judgment against Richter?
Yes.
And
the industry, not individually, but the corporation.
And what is required for the effectiveness of a personal judgment in terms of the commencement of the action in order for the court to gain personal jurisdiction to order or issue a personal judgment?
Under the garnishment statute, it would be service of the garnishment, earnings garnishment on the employer and employee, and it lists various ways that can be done, and the way I did it was by certified mail return receipt requested.
Counsel?
Well, to follow up on that issue, yes. I understand that the garnishment statutes for purposes of earnings garnishments don't state any requirement that a summons accompany the form that the clerk issues after you, the creditor, files the notice with the clerk. However, the garnishment statutes do incorporate the general rules of civil procedure, including those that pertain to the acquisition of personal jurisdiction for purposes of acquiring an enforceable personal judgment against somebody. And that does require the service of a summons. Otherwise, there isn't any personal jurisdiction for purposes of an enforceable personal judgment.
That is not what the statutes say. I understand what you're saying, but the statutes do not require that a summons be served.
The statutes do incorporate, by reference, all of the requirements of the General Code of Civil Procedure.
Unless otherwise stated in the rules or statutes.
So, just so I get this straight, and you've heard the question asked, by Justice Rogan Sack and by Justice Sykes, was it, a summons was not served here.
There was no summons to the garnishee.
As to the garnishee, thank you.
Okay. Now, 812.41 says, if a garnishee fails to pay over funds to which it's entitled, the creditor may, upon notice to all of the parties.
Correct.
That's what you're operating under.
Right.
Right.
So your position, if I understand it, is you have complied with the garnishment statutes.
Correct.
As to what you had to advise the garnishee about. And that then, if you want to have liability for the entire debt or any part thereof, you had to give notice to all the parties and move the court for a judgment in the amount of the unsatisfied judgment, and that's what you did.
Yes.
And that there's no requirement here on a summons.
There is no requirement that I am aware of. That's correct.
In the garnishment proceedings.
Correct.
But there is a requirement that you give notice to all the parties.
And that is true. That's that 812 section, right?
And where do you then find that the garnishee is a party? I mean, we're assuming the garnishee is a party. And I assume that it's a party because of your having given the notice under 812.
Well, it's the earnings garnishment. The notice got filed with the court. The notice itself did not go to the garnishee.
Well, 812.35 says to commence an earnings garnishment proceeding, which this is, right?
Correct.
The judgment creditor, that's you, Kenosha, right?
Correct.
Shall file with the clerk of courts a garnishment notice under 812.44(2). And you did that?
Correct.
All right. So that's under the statute, that's how you proceed.
That's how the garnishment notice itself does not get served on the garnishee, though. There's a separate document.
Does not get served like what?
The garnishee. The garnishment notice just gets filed with the court. The employer or employee do not get that.
And what does the employer or employee get?
Earnings garnishment form. Basically, it has the caption. It identifies the judgment, identifies the balance due. On the back side of the earnings garnishment, there is a summary of the garnishment laws and directives to the garnishee what has to be done once he receives the garnishment.
Is that under 812.44? Is that 2 or is that a 3?
I'm sorry, I don't have the sections here.
Pardon me?
I don't have those section numbers. But.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we can look that up. Go ahead.
Counselor, I have to back you up a little bit. I have now the record in front of me with the notice of motion and motion for judgment against the garnishee, and there's nothing in here that says you're seeking a judgment for $20,000 or really any dollar amount. If this is what was served in lieu of a summons, it doesn't tell you anything about the amount.
Yeah, I believe it said something about the judgment equal to the entire judgment against the employee.
Against the debtor. That's what it says, but there's no dollar amount in here, whether it's for $100 or $500.
That could be. That may well be.
Thank you.
Could I ask, how big is this operation, Richter Industries?
I have no idea, Your Honor. They have not responded to anything except for the motion to reopen, and in those proceedings, there's been nothing offered.
You have no idea how many people work there? Or
I have no knowledge of it. There's nothing in the record to show that.
Do you, maybe I shouldn't ask this, but what the heck. What really went on here?
What went on is Richter Industries just ignored everything. To my surprise, and a judgment has now been entered against them. Unfortunately, their employee has gone bankrupt, and I am looking at Richter Industries solely to pay this debt. If the employee had not gone bankrupt, I think the hospital would have been satisfied continuing collecting the money from Mr. Garcia. But right now, we cannot. We cannot go against Mr. Garcia.
Can Richter Industries go against Mr. Garcia now that he's bankrupt?
It would be my position it cannot, that that would be barred by the injunction issued in the bankruptcy under 524. I think it would be barred by the Consumer Credit Protection Act. This is a debt that Mr. Garcia has been discharged on.
Well, you want to collect more than $20,000 from Richter Industries because they didn't file some paperwork and didn't respond timely and timely pay over, well, certainly less than $1,000 before January 2nd when the judgment was entered. And they can't ever collect anything from the debtor. Why should we approve that?
Basically, that's what the statute allows. The statute allows for a judgment against the garnishee if he does not respond. If he had responded and brought in Mr. Garcia's pay records, that would have been a cap on the garnishee's liability. He saw fit not to do that. The other reason this should be allowed is because the discharge has no effect on Richter Industries. The discharge injunction in Section 524 does not apply the liability of any other entity on a debt or the property of any other entity for the debt, and that's 524 sub E. The argument is being made that because Mr. Garcia went bankrupt, therefore we are enjoined from proceeding against Richter Industries, and it's my position that we are not, that that garnishment does not affect the liability of Richter Industries. And that's the cases I cited in my brief, and I acknowledge there are contrary decisions that basically look to the fresh start of the debtor. My response to that is I think the debtor has adequate protection. It initially has the protection of the discharge injunction that's granted by the bankruptcy court. It does have the Consumer Credit Protection Act. And in addition, it's got Wisconsin Statute Section 812.43, which protects the which protects the employee from actions by the employer and allows for the recovery of back wages, reinstatement of employment, and reasonable attorney's fees. And it seems that most of these cases that cover this are in bankruptcy court brought by the debtor or the debtor and the employer together. There are some cases where each of the debtor and the employer are even represented by the same counsel. We don't know what's going on. We don't know if Mr. Garcia is still employed by Richter Industries. We don't know if Mr. Garcia is going to be subject to any harassment by Richter Industries if this judgment stays.
Does the earnings garnishment form that is issued by the clerk after the filing of the notice of garnishment, and which was, in this case, served, I think you said, by certified mail, correct?
Yes.
Does that form contain any warning to the garnishee that failure to respond will expose the garnishee to a personal liability, personal judgment for the entire amount of the debtors?
I can't swear to that at this moment. There may well be. The backside of the garnishment has a pretty good summary of the entire bankruptcy law on it that is instructions to the garnishee. I don't know if that's there.
Let's assume it's not there.
Okay.
And it's your position that an independent summons containing such a warning is not required for earnings garnishments, correct?
Correct.
How can that satisfy due process?
because of a notice that I had served on Richter Industries that notified him or the entity what the plaintiff was seeking if he did not respond.
That's later down the road, though.
Correct.
I'm talking about at the commencement of the garnishment. You're talking about what you served later when you moved for default.
All right. You're talking about the initial garnishment papers that were served by certified mail.
Right. If those papers don't contain some sort of notice to the garnishee that failure to respond will expose the garnishee to personal liability for the debtor's entire underlying debt, how can that satisfy due process for purposes of a valid and enforceable personal judgment?
Again, it may well be there. I guess that's the whole concept of what a garnishment is. It's a garnishment that puts the recipient of the garnishment papers on notice that they're in jeopardy if they turn over property.
I understand that. And the idea is that to the extent that the garnishee is holding funds belonging to the debtor, those funds belong to the creditor.
Correct.
But what and that's more in the nature of an in rem kind of a jurisdictional grounds or basis, because you're targeting those
I understand
funds.
What you're saying, yes.
Seeking a personal judgment against
at that point,
the garnishee. But failure to respond will expose the garnishee to personal liability for the entire underlying debt.
Potentially,
and
yes.
And that's my point about due process notice. And that's why summonses are required for any other form of personal jurisdiction over a defendant.
I understand the point you're making. There is no summons. There was no summons. There is no summons in this file. There is no summons served on Richter Industries.
You think this garnishment statute's constitutional?
I haven't briefed that, Your Honor.
You just follow it.
correct.
A good idea. All right. So this is a kind of in rem because there's property and therefore different kinds of notices and different kinds of service might be required. Now, you've got the notice of the earnings garnishment notice. After that, the clerk issued another document, right?
Numerous other documents.
None of which the clerk filed.
None of which are filed with the court, correct.
Kenosha County Circuit Court, does it have rules of court relating to garnishment?
Yes.
And what do they provide about all of this?
At this point, I can't answer that.
One assumes that either you or the clerk or both attempted to follow them.
There is no requirement for additional filings.
All right. Then what does 812, and maybe you should look at it in the statute book. Volume 4 is 812.35. Now, 2. 2. A1235, maybe this is not what we're under, but at least let's start with 2. It says, upon receipt of the notice under 1, and that's in the file here. Is that correct?
Correct.
And payment of the fee, which you said was paid, but that's not in the file. The clerk of court shall issue 2 earnings garnishment form under 812.44.3, and that's a long form, and that's not in the... in the record either. Is that the form we're talking about?
Yes.
All right. Then it says a circuit court may permit by rule the clerk to do something. That circuit rule shall require the notice to be filed with the court at a later time, but no later than 5 days after the date the garnishee is served under 3. See that?
What section?
812.35.2. It's the last sentence. Now, which notice has to be filed? Maybe only the notice under 1? That circuit court shall require the notice.
The document that is titled notice, at least in Kenosha County, right, must be filed prior to the plaintiff getting the garnishment forms.
Right. And so that has been filed here. So there's, your position is there's nothing requiring him to, the clerk or you, to file the earnings garnishment form.
That's correct.
That's the long form under 8.12.44.
And the form that's generated, long paragraphs determine whether you will owe the debtor earnings. That's on the back side of the form in Kenosha County.
Okay. And that complies with sub 3. And I've read that quickly. I don't know that that said anything about how much, what's the effect of not answering. But the earnings garnishment notice does have a statement that the amount of the original judgment and the amount unpaid is over $21,000. So that's what the
and the earnings garnishment that was served by certified mail has that amount in it.
That's right. And the notice of motion and motion for judgment has says, notifies, and that if that you're asking for a judgment in the amount of the judgment against the defendant, Garcia, which you've already given notice that it's $21,000 plus.
All right, quick.
All right. So that's, I assume you're going to say that that's why they got all the notices. They got a notice of the garnishment, they got a notice of your motion for a judgment. Notice for motion of judgment read with the other documents said you're going to hold them for $21,000.
That's my position, yes.
And they didn't answer.
Not only did they didn't answer, they did not appear in court in response to the motion. And that would have been the simplest thing, and I honestly expected it to happen.
Just want to just get the facts, as at least as we can understand it. That still leaves the bankruptcy issue.
Correct.
On that, you have a judgment that was dated January 7th, the same date that the bankruptcy proceeding?
I will acknowledge that the judgment, the order for judgment and judgment signed was signed on the same day as the bankruptcy was filed. I would point out, though, that the judgment was granted and ordered by Judge Bastianelli 5 days before that on January 2nd.
Suppose it all been signed on January 2nd. Would your position be stronger? I mean, I ask the same question.
Yeah, I believe it would probably be a little bit stronger. I don't think it's determinative. The judgment was granted. For some reason, the order for judgment was not signed until the 7th, whether Judge Bastianelli was in a jury trial. I don't know what the reason was. There's nothing in the record.
In light of your real position, though, is it's not a judgment against Garcia, so it has nothing to do with bankruptcy.
That's my belief, yes, that this is basically a new obligation.
Of a new debtor.
A new obligation with a new debtor, correct, that is still exists after Mr. Garcia is discharged in bankruptcy.
What about all this problem about potentially holding it against Mr. Garcia, and that it really defies the underlying concept of bankruptcy, that you give the debtor a fresh start, and all we've done, if we accept your position, is jeopardize his job?
In all the cases that I've read on this issue, there is no evidence of any employee being harmed. There's always the concern of the courts that it could happen. It's my position if the employee were harmed, this particular employee had a very good bankruptcy lawyer who could protect him. And if that lawyer wasn't interested, there are many other lawyers that would be interested in a case where an employer did some harm to an employee as a result of a garnishment.
Are there any further questions? Hearing none.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
First of all, a couple of points on some of the comments that Mr. Dearson made. He's referring to, he talks about that the notices were served on a plant in Kenosha. Jane Doe's secretary accepted service, that this was the office, the registered office in Wisconsin, and this is why the notice, either the earnings garnishment notice or the notice for default was either sent or served there. That may be his position. I'm quite frankly not clear on where that comes from, because my review of the record and what I filed with my notice of motion to vacate was documents showing that the registered office, registered agent for the corporation, Richter Industries, was not anywhere in Wisconsin, but was in fact in Illinois. It was at one time in Wisconsin, but in fact the registered office and registered agent was in Illinois and not Wisconsin. I know he's stated that fact in his brief. He stated that fact to the court, the trial court at the time he brought this, and he stated that fact here today. But I don't know where that comes from, because that's my only that's my client's position, which is why we filed it with the notice of motion when we talked about the service issue. But that's my only information that's available
in
the record.
Counselor, aren't all corporations that do business in Wisconsin required to maintain a registered agent for service within the state?
No, either within or without the state, I believe.
You think you can do business in Wisconsin as a corporation and have no place in Wisconsin that you can be served? Well, it's been a while since I've practiced corporate law, but there was always a necessity that anybody that did business in Wisconsin had to maintain a registered agent in Wisconsin. Now, this might not have been the registered agent where service was accomplished, according to opposing counsel, but I find that a surprising position that you can do business in Wisconsin and maintain no place in Wisconsin to be served.
Well, I think the statute I'm not 100% certain of that, but I know that the statute in terms of serving says that it can be served on the corporation either within the state or outside of the state wherever
right.
the registered office
is. That's true, but that's a separate question about whether the corporation is obligated to maintain an office for service or an agent. It used to be something called Service Systems Corporation that tons and tons of foreign corporations registered with, and you serve them. So, I mean, you may be right, but that's something it's a different position.
All right.
Could you give, don't give evidence, but give me some theories why Richter didn't respond to any of these notices?
Well, the only thing that I know is that it was served on some secretary at a plant in Kenosha, and Mr. Eric Richter never had a knowledge of it. And after he got this notice, I believe that he had a default judgment against him that was entered on January 7th. That's when he came to us and said, you know, we have this default judgment. I don't know what this is all about.
Just if you're going to maintain that, what about the original service on Richter where he signed the certified mail receipt?
Well, the original service that we're talking about, the earnings garnishment notice,
right.
He may have, in fact, received that, and that's why they started deducting the wages. They may not have done it immediately or right away, but they did start deducting the wages. Then at some point, the Kenosha Hospital filed the motion for default judgment, which was served on the plant in Kenosha, served on a secretary who wouldn't give the name, and that was not forwarded to Eric Richter. And Mr. Richter only got knowledge of that after he came back from vacation And after receiving this noticing a default judgment for $21,000 had been entered against you, now what do we do?
Yeah, but this is like the excuse that the cat knocked the papers off the piano and I didn't find them until 2 months later. The point is that what you're saying is that there was a lack of knowledge on Richter's part.
There was a lack of knowledge about the notice of motion for default judgment and the fact that a hearing was scheduled in January. Otherwise, they would have been there.
Counsel, we're here, as I understand it, as a result of a default judgment being entered and a motion to vacate the default judgment being denied. And that's what I want to focus on. In your motion, you raise two things. First of all, service should have been in Illinois. And in your written motion, you also raise that because of the implication of bankruptcy, the judgment is void. Those are the issues you raised. Did you raise under 80607 excusable neglect or mistake?
I didn't specifically raise that. I did request, however, that the court vacate the default judgment. One of the arguments that was made in the court, in the trial court, was exactly that they never received notice. I didn't specifically say excusable neglect, but I don't know that I'm really required to, because once I'm putting them on notice, that being the court.
Let me ask this then. It seems to me you've got a couple of legal issues that you've set forth in your written motion. Then apparently you had some equitable arguments you made. Maybe let's put them in the umbrella of in the interest of justice. That's your umbrella here in your brief. And those include, you said, and you start out with your argument in your brief, in the interest of justice, this isn't our deck.
Right.
So the judge listened to, this isn't our debt, according to you, the argument you made, and the judge listened to the excusable neglect mistake sort of argument that you made, and the judge, in the judge's discretion, didn't accept those arguments in the interest of justice or excusable neglect. Now, why should we, as a reviewing court, say, we will accept the excusable neglect or mistake argument, or we will accept the, this really isn't my debt argument. Given our standard of review, why should our sense of justice trump the trial court's sense of justice?
Well, first of all, it's erroneous exercise of discretion. I mean, our argument here, the
reason
why...
Which means just because we like it or don't like it, that's not good enough to trump our...
Well, just because you may like it or don't like it, no, that wouldn't be.
An erroneous exercise of discretion means what?
Well, the court was quite frankly incorrect in its decision.
Incorrect in the law?
Incorrect in the law or the application of the law to the facts. And the reason why I say incorrect in the law, and I think this is why we're here, really, is because of the position that was really not the position at the time we were arguing that we're taking, and that the minority position, if you want to call it that, that the garnishment here and the default judgment after the bankruptcy was filed, that in and of itself, that judgment is void, and because of the fact that it contravenes the bankruptcy code. And I don't believe that the trial court certainly can't make law. I think the only thing the trial court had before it at the time was one case, which was the only case that we could quite frankly find dealing with whether or not the court had jurisdiction, which, really may not have been, it was on point to some things, but it wasn't really on point to the interest of justice argument that we're making here today.
Counselor, I have one question, even though your red light is on. Section 180, 1507, still requires foreign corporations to maintain both a registered agent and a registered office within the state of Wisconsin if they're doing business here for service of process. Now, first of all, it's my understanding Richter is an Illinois corporation. Is that correct?
Correct.
Do you know whether the plant that was served in Kenosha is either the registered office or the registered agent required by statute?
My understanding is that the writer stop from registered agents, as we put in forth in the record, is in Illinois.
But that's contrary to statute. They're required to have one within the
state.
Well,
it may, whether it's contrary to statute or not, I think the point is, though, that it's the service argument, that they have to do serve that corporation. I don't know that we're
really... Well, that's why you have to have a registered office and a registered agent by statute. So if someone's doing business in Wisconsin and they're a California corporation... We don't have to send folks to California. We can serve them within the state for actions taken within the state. And if you don't know if that is or that isn't, that's a good enough answer for me, but I guess that's my question to you. Do you know if it is or it is not? And your answer is you don't think it is. You think they only have one in Illinois?
I believe so. That's correct.
Well, but okay, counsel, there's another statute that says if you don't have a registered agent in Wisconsin, then you can serve at the principal office of the corporation.
Correct, and that's Illinois.
Taken care of under 180.0501 through 180.0504.
Which is Illinois.
Whereas it's, other than the plant in Kenosha, is there any other plant, any other office, or anything else of your client? This is beyond the record, but is there?
Beyond the record?
No.
Oh,
do you know of any?
Quite frankly, I'm not sure of that question, of that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you to both counsel, Mr. Rose and Mr. Gerson, for... trying to enlighten us on two areas of the law, which, as you can tell, the court has limited prior experience with, either as counsel or on the bench, both bankruptcy and garnishment. So I want to thank you both for your arguments today, and that concludes the hearing on 02-1727, Kenosha Hospital and Medical Center versus Garcia. And we will take a few moments in recess so that the students who are leaving may leave and new students may come in. Thank you.